to start the meeting, whether it's an official meeting, I don't know yet, but... One, two...
Oh, we need a quorum wise, no.
Yeah. Four, five. Yeah. Half here. That'd be good.
I just got an email from Senator Benson who said she's...
So we'll start the meeting, and I just wanted to make two announcements. One, the governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force on the medical school is going to be dealing with workforce issues at their next meeting, which is October 15th. So, and I'm on that board, but some of the rest of you might want to attend that. It's at 9:30 on the 15th, and it's... the Lions building at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis campus, which is right by the stadium. And, Mark is also there. And so that'd be the October 15th. And the second thing I just wanted to say is the University of Minnesota released their budget proposal. And there's a lot of talk about tuition freezes and whatnot, but buried in their report, at least buried in the newspaper account of it, one of the things they want is some additional money to be spent on healthcare workforce, training of people for that. So the university is already thinking about what we're doing, and we have another sheet that Mark will be talking about later that lists all the groups in the state that are working on workforce issues. Okay, so those are my two announcements. We don't have the minutes, right?
Mr. Chair, we don't have the minutes.
Yeah, okay.
There was a huge data dump last time, so we'll have them next time.
Okay. Let's go on to the number two item, which is Dr. Baganko to talk about foreign trained physician task force, and that was a task force that was set up in 2014, and Dr. Baganko is the chair of that committee, so if you could just give us a report. I know you're in kind of a hurry.
Not really. Representative Huntley, thank you for the opportunity. To the other members, Senator Clausen, Senator Wickland, Senator Laurie, I think it's a privilege for me to be here today to sort of speak a little bit about a journey that I myself went through and so many others have been very, very unfortunate not to experience. I don't see a very big difference between myself and those that cannot practice because of inability to get into the system. And so it's very fitting for me to be a part of this work, and hopefully some of the ideas we bring forward will be helpful to the state of Minnesota and also help some of these physicians work within their communities where they are very, very much needed. Just a recap of the committee that we have. It was established with a very clear charge, and that is to develop strategies to integrate refugee and asylee physicians into the Minnesota healthcare delivery system. And we had five elements of that. Was it possible for us to figure out how many of them are there in the state, both currently in the workforce and not in the workforce, and how they are distributed? What are some of the costs and barriers that are preventing them from entering the workforce? And look at different ways that we can integrate them. So can we find them alternative roles and professions, so where they can sort of put their expertise to work? And look at the possibility of looking at alternative sources of funding. We've had two meetings so far with a very inclusive group that has both individuals from higher education, representing PA training programs, nursing programs. We have employers represented there. We have people from civil society who have been involved with these physicians in trying to help them integrate, find them housing, find them appropriate places to work because they can't use their physician training. And so it's been very interesting to hear stories that sort of pique your conscience because they're very highly trained, some subspecialist trained physicians who have either no work or are working in nursing homes as nursing assistants, totally misplaced in view of their expertise. I think the underlying or underpinning concern is Minnesota has a provider shortage, especially in primary care. We're very sensitive to the question of health equity, health disparities. And we are a magnet for refugees. We have a large population of individuals who are not born here, have come here because of conflicts in their countries. And with that migration came different professions, among them physicians. And we have not been able to get these physicians a place where they can actually serve their own communities. Some of those barriers are not very easy to address because they are statutory and regulatory and legal. But it's really, really interesting that we're not the only state that has looked at this particular conundrum. So I want to just highlight some of the ideas that we have come up with so far. In California, the UCLA developed a program identifying Spanish-speaking physicians to serve their large Mexican and Spanish-speaking population, individuals who had migrated to the United States. And they had a public and private partnership to develop an actual training program that was funded by some state dollars, some private dollars, to help integrate these physicians into their own communities. And it's a success story that we would be able to share when our work is done. Is it possible that we can find a way to develop a similar sort of integrated model, specifically addressing these communities that we know are not having representation in the healthcare space? What about residency programs that say that these physicians are already trained? They're coming from a different environment. We need to figure out how can they be comfortable treating an American patient. The nuances of practice in the United States. Is that distance too large to travel, or should we take them straight to the beginning where we say, well, we don't really trust you, you know anything, and you have to go through all the hoops one more time? Is there a possibility that there is space for us to bypass the traditional residency training pathway so that we can integrate these individuals into our workplace? What about identifying private dollars and some state dollars so that we can incent current training programs to expand slots within their residences with a very specific mandate of integrating some of these foreign-trained physicians with the intent that they will be reintegrated back to their communities and serve there. A state-level program like the MAC funding program was one area that we sort of discussed and said something very similar and say, can the state of Minnesota say, we have this population of refugees, we need to address their health equity in those communities, and how can we provide a sustainable way of creating this integration? 20 years from now, it might not be a big deal because a lot of these communities are developing their own medical students who speak their own language, who are going to American medical schools. But we have a ready workforce now who have reached the point where there is no road ahead. We've had some ideas about fundraising. Entities like the Council of Health Plans and Foundations, the Clinton Foundation, Gates Foundation, who have pioneered the whole idea of global health and reducing health disparities. How can we call on this sort of non-traditional funding sources to help us develop solutions so that we can integrate these professionals. So that sort of addresses the issue of how do we finance, assuming that we get to a point where we have some options, where do we get the dollars to do this work? And so those are some of the ideas that have come out of that. I think the other side of the coin is, can we provide a compelling case that we can ascertain that these physicians are competent? Are they competent to do the work we say we want them to do? And how can we verify that their training is commensurate with an American-trained physician? So in the area of competency, I think that we've identified a lot of barriers. If you're going to go into a residency program today, you need to show that you have American experience. You've been in an American hospital room, done a history and physical, and you understand the nuances of practicing evidence-based medicine, and that you're competent in the area of English language. And yet, as we are in this world of HIPAA and privacy, most institutions have limited those opportunities. And so these individuals do not have, and unless you know a physician who can really vouch for you, a lot of them are basically no opportunity to get this very key ingredient that every program asks about, which is U.S. Training experience. So is it possible that we can create a pathway to provide opportunities for clinical experience? Second, some customized training programs, and this is where the public-private partnership can come in. How do we just take them through a program that can take them from where they are and make them sort of residency ready so that they can be attractive to any residency program in the United States? And hopefully when they're ready to join the workforce, they can come back and serve their communities. What about the question of alternative certification? I've had the opportunity to work with a few of these foreign-trained professionals, and it's gut-wrenching. I had a lady from Russia who was a trained cardiologist, published multiple international papers. For 5 years, she could not get anywhere. And just this past year, we were able to help her get into a program out in New York. We have a very large Russian population in Minnesota. And my thought was, why would we let a state like New York finally see value in somebody who would have been in the workforce and already integrated in our community that we have here in Minnesota? So I feel very strongly that the fear of competency is a big barrier. And so nobody wants to put too much time into it. Our group feels that it's important for us to look at the potential for this alternative certification or a way to verify how do we figure out what can you really do. Increasing funding slots for funding and slots for residency, and looking at some ways either of, for example, the Office of Refugees and Resettlement. This is one of their biggest issues about resettling professionals and doctors among them. And they would be another resource to figure out how can we partner with them to not so much give them jobs, but have them bridge the gap of either knowledge gap, practice gap, language, the things that they need in order to be easily integrated to our system. There is the question of J-1 visas, which is, again, tied to some of federal regulations and paid by employers. Is it possible for us to relook into that area and give incentives to those that wish to take these physicians and give them some breaks as far as the J-1 regulations are concerned? Ultimately, I think that when we look at programs like the ones they've done at UCLA, this can be done. You can look at a community that is lacking in their access to healthcare from professionals that speak their language. Use local resources, use the combination of state and private funding to address a problem. Perhaps the most compelling barrier of all is if you're going to come here and say, I want to go through the process, I want to take my test so that I can be ready. When I came here, I had to sit the same exam that fourth-year medical students do when they're leaving med school. That's the That's the bar you have to pass. So then it shows that you have the same training and experience as somebody leaving medical school. It costs money. So if you come here and you're driving a cab or you're working in a nursing home and you have to spend close to $3,000-$4,000 to do this test and do the training, it's basically become a choice of, do I put food on the table for my family or do I follow a dream and leave my family hungry? And I think it's probably an unfair situation to be in. During our meetings, it's been very somber. We've had a lady who was not just a pediatrician, but a pediatric endocrinologist, very highly trained. And to hear what she has had to go through was, brought a lot of us close to tears. It's one of those things that it makes you wonder, are we missing something? I think from our task force, even though we are just almost halfway, we are very open and inclusive, and we're getting a lot of views. In the past month alone, I've had calls or emails from close to 20 physicians who are either international trained physicians or physicians who work in very underserved communities who have a lot of ideas, and they believe that this is the right work. It's not an easy solution to develop. But they are very hopeful that we can come up with something not only comprehensive but practical and hopefully sustainable. So I will stop there and say that thank you for having me. So far, that's how far we have gone. We have a lot of small work groups looking at areas of training, areas of private foundations and how we can look at different dollars to help in this training program. We have a group looking at the foreign trained physicians themselves. How can we better identify them and meet some of the needs that they have? And we're very hopeful that at the end of the day, we can make some recommendations that will be worthy of your consideration. Thank you for having me.
Are there questions? Lori.
Dr. Bergonco, thank you for your work. I know that this is something that, like you said, many states have struggled with, and it is there are many lost opportunities that we hear about, but the very issues that you're struggling with are the ones that we struggle with too. And so we're very looking forward to your recommendations this December as we come back in. In terms of the funding for residency slots, are you envisioning new residency slots or funding to help encourage existing residency slots to take these positions? I mean, because this is one of the things we wind up dealing with everywhere is the lack of existing residency slots.
So having been to different residency directors' offices, addressing this issue, I think it's a little bit of both. I don't see how... Residencies are really struggling with funding, as it is. There are caps on slots that are allocated to residency training programs. So it's going to be a little bit of both. If we are going to get alternative sources of funding and say, we're going to say give a program like Hennepin, we should also give them the opportunity to develop some expansion because they have other needs too. We probably have more needs than the residency slots. So it has to be a little bit of a hybrid. But I think if we got some dollars that allows these programs to expand their residency slots, I'll give you a good example. If I have a hospital in Brainerd that is willing to be part of a training program, say for primary care, with a sponsor like the University or Hennepin County Medical Center, and we've got funding for that, we would say, for example, why don't you take two foreign trained physicians and train them, and also take two from the community, and so those are four, so you get half and half. So there's an incentive for them to expand their programs. But it's going to take us integrating some of the rural hospitals in this work because in the city, if you ask any clinic or healthcare center, medical center in the city, they are so swamped with requests for training opportunities from the university, from all the training programs. We need to sort of go a little bit further. and include some of our regional hospitals in this work, and it will take partnerships between those regional hospitals and existing training centers. And I think it's going to be funding for both. It will be very hard to make an argument that just create this sort of unique program just for the foreign trained professionals, because that will be harder to justify for those programs.
And then,
Senator Ori.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. One additional question, maybe a little bit more difficult, and maybe you don't have the answer for this yet, but really there's a couple of problems we always face. Number one is funding. Number two is policy. Do you think that, and I'm certain there will be funding issues that come forward, but do you think that your work group is structured broad enough and working well enough that you'll have a pretty sound consensus on the right policy to ensure that we have the competencies to allow these foreign-trained doctors to practice in some capacity in Minnesota? Do you think you'll have a pretty broad consensus policy-wise, and the question left to the legislature will be funding, or is it too early to say that with any certainty?
I'll say a few things. One, I think it's probably too early, but we're very inclusive. We have a broad-based representation in our task force. We have IMGs themselves. We have groups that have been working with these IMGs to address not just getting into the workforce, but even getting them housing, getting them, you know, to take their kids to school. We have groups that have had to settle these people in their communities. We have groups like Mayo that have been struggling with the same issue and trying to figure out how can they help. We have a representative from the university. If you recall the PRP program, I don't know if you're familiar with that. We had some dollars given to the family residency training program at the U to train some of these IMGs for a year and create a sense of readiness for them to start residency. And it was a very good experience. It helped sort of figure out what is the best way to get these physicians to be ready to join the workforce. And they had some challenges, and the funding was for a very short period of time. But we have some limited experience, and the principals of that program are part of our task force. So we're getting a lot of input from, as I said, higher education, from civil society, from the IMGs themselves, who we've invited as an open invitation to be part of our meetings. So I'm very confident that we'll have some broad-based consensus around the recommendations that we bring forth to the committee.
Good. Other questions? I don't see. Oh, Senator Kloss.
No, thank you, Representative Huntley. And Dr. Baganko, again, thank you for being here today. I'm wondering how many foreign-trained physicians are waiting for residency slots. Do you have any idea about the number of people that we're talking about? And then secondly, you've outlined some of those barriers, and I'm wondering if you could prioritize and give us the top two barriers that you see in preventing foreign-trained physicians from entering the workforce.
Dr. Baganko.
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. There are probably, from the numbers that we have, I'd say between 250 and 300 foreign-trained physicians in Minnesota who are not practicing because they have not been able to get residency. Now, where they are in their journey to be ready for residency, I can't ascertain, but there are a lot of groups working with these different physicians, and that's information that we can collect. I think the biggest barriers, as I see them, one of it is we don't have many training programs in the state. We have Mayo, we have the university, we have Hennepin, and then we have the family residency programs that are scattered, you know, a little bit in Mankato, in St. Cloud, and in the metro, and that's it. And so I think that's a big barrier, because the number of physicians that we have to train from the state to serve our communities sometimes is at variance with the idea that we have to serve this individual sort of subset of our population. So what I get feedback from the training directors is we don't have enough slots in the state. So I think that's a big barrier. The second barrier is the fact that if you are a resident, a doctor who has been out of med school for more than 5 years, regardless of the extent of your expertise, you're a very low priority candidate for training programs across the country. And so you have to just work a little harder to justify why you need to be taken. I would add that number three is a lack of a very clear pathway, I think, in my opinion, to get to residency, because of all these hoops that they have to jump, and they cost money. So if we can be able to develop a framework for a clear pathway from start to finish and say, this is how we can help you go along the way, I think that would be a big deal. I often say that because we have not enough residency programs, if we are just able to make this residency ready, they can go to other states too. There are a lot of states that are struggling to get residents. But we can help them get to be ready, maybe go to other states and come back and serve their communities. I think that's still a big victory, in my opinion. That would be a big duty that we've done for these physicians. So money, a framework, and the fact that the issue of limited slots, I think, my top three barriers, as far as I can tell, based on our discussion so far.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did very well. You were really smooth. Dr. Boganko, thank you for being here today to have your knowledge and your expertise in regards to the matter in front of us right now. And I think my fellow members have asked some good questions. Mine for you, though, is a little bit more, having been to Guatemala on a surgical medical mission trip as a nurse, one of the things that I found very challenging was the language and the culture. And there is no question that I thought to myself as I was listening to your response that it's, I know for us, what we said or what we thought we hoped we said in another culture and another language had very different meanings. And that must be a huge hurdle. I think the medical skill and expertise, the body is a body and a lot of these good cares and things, but medicine is more than just that technical side. Does your organization or is this group have a transition time to help bridge the culture and the language? Sometimes when you're taking care of patients who are hard of hearing, understanding, but do you have something within your own organization group or anywhere at all that helps to make that bridge of language culture as well?
Dr. Boganko.
Yeah, so we have a lot of groups that are part of our task force that have been doing that for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Identify who are these foreign trained physicians. They've developed a cohort of these physicians. And one of the things that comes out of that is the whole question of acculturation, language and culture. And the things that you've so eloquently talked about. I think, yes, it's a significant barrier on the part of foreign-trained physicians to overcome. What is health? What's your orientation towards, what does it take, for example, to treat a condition? Is it what you hear and see, or is it evidence that, yes, it is present and let me treat and so on and so forth. I think when you're coming from a very low resource environment and then coming to the United States where you have to show evidence that somebody has something, it's a little bit difficult to sort of jump there. So I do agree with you that the issue of culture and sort of acclimatizing to the nuances of American medicine is a challenge, and I think it's something that can be done pre what we're doing, and it takes helping these groups that integrate the physicians into just American life to begin with to address that particular aspect. But I do agree it's a big deal, and some of the directors will tell you the same, that if somebody is very well trained and they can't speak good English, it's, you know, I want to take you, but I don't know whether I'll have to have an interpreter with you for the next 3 years during your training. And so that becomes an issue. So I think you raise a very important point. Part of the solutions we're going to come up with will, this framework that we're talking about will involve that particular aspect. How do we integrate them from a culture standpoint, mm-hmm. and not just a professional aspect?
Thank you, Dr. Burganko. I think, Mr. Chairman, that's some of the practical side of this is more often just a real challenge. But I think of the stories that we've read in regards to South Africa, and when you mentioned cardiology, Dr. Burganko, I think of the very first external heart support or that great big huge machine that actually pumped for people came out of South Africa. And so there are many tremendous things that are being done, not in the U.S., that have very qualified, competent people that could be a real resource to us here. But it's both the practical and some of the refugee financial situations that do that. But I think the hardest thing is to sort out those which truly are of that exceptional caliber that we want to be sure we do that. So I'm really glad to hear you, Dr. Burganko, say that you're dealing with all of those areas, and look forward to your recommendations. Thank you.
Senator Lurie.
You know, kind of tying a couple of these issues together, I mean, Senator Claussen's question was how many foreign-trained doctors are there in Minnesota, but then also to getting the most qualified, I think if we kind of figure this out and open up some residency slots, it's actually a national pool that we're going for the most qualified, because no other states have figured this out either. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if we're losing the cardiologist to New York, we can, you know, if we figure this out and get it well, my gut is that we'd be in a good position to be drawing from a national pool of foreign-trained doctors for those most ready to enter the healthcare workforce. I mean, give me your insights into that. Is my gut decent on that, or are you...
I think there are a lot of states grappling with this. About 4.5 years ago, I was involved in discussions with the Office of Refugees and Resettlement, talking about the same problem and how they are trying to figure out which states are struggling with. We're not the only state. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's been a clear understanding of how to address it. Having said that, I think there are two sides of it. One is we already have a very large refugee population in Minnesota. I think our allegiance goes to those communities. How can we need to bridge the gap. I think we've been doing some data mining to see how many doctors from those communities are already in the workforce, and it's very clear that they are not well represented. I do think, however, as I said before, that if you develop a very clear pathway of taking a physician from country A who doesn't speak very good English, making them ready, ascertaining their competence, and they get through and start practicing, I cannot imagine how the other states would not borrow on Minnesota example and develop this pool of talent that we can all benefit from.
Other questions? Well, I don't see any. I just had a couple of comments. So thank you for your testimony, thank you for being here, and thank you for the work you're doing. And the language problem is a huge problem. My understanding is Somalis don't even have words for a lot of parts of our anatomy, and it's very difficult then to, even if you have a good translator there, how do you communicate? So that is a big issue. I will say, Senator Kiffmeyer, that the South African physician that did the first heart transplant was trained at the Minneapolis campus.
He was just waiting for that. Even better. Bring him back home.
So with that, thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Next is Doug Berg's going to talk about where we're spending money on healthcare workforce training. Or are we going to go to Mark first?
No, just
Betty's. We'll do.
They're both there. Yeah. Okay.
We'll do the next part together. But you could just maybe related to Dr. Burganko's presentation, Mr. Chairman and members, you do have and I saw many of you found it, a handout on the project that talks about the charge that the legislature gave this task force, and on the back you will find a list of the members. Mr. Chairman, you also mentioned the numerous healthcare workforce policy efforts going on simultaneously, and members, you have a handout on that as well. You have now heard updates from two of them. Number two, the Foreign Trained Physician Task Force, and at your last meeting, number four, the Mental Health Workforce Summit. Numbers two, three, four, and five will be were created by and will be reporting back to you at the legislature. Chairman Huntley mentioned number one, the Blue Ribbon Commission, and we've had some previous discussion on number six, the NGA project. So this is just for your background information. I think as you move towards a final report, you want to figure out if and how kind of weave in some of these other activities.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump. Maybe I'll jump chairs here.
Mr. Schoenbaum, if you could, just to me personally, have somebody give me an update on what the National Governors Association Health Workforce Policy, I'm what they're doing. I'm very familiar with how they got this grant and whatnot, but I haven't heard anything since they started.
Happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. It is moving along, and we'll get you the details.
Okay.
Before we kind of dive into the detailed update, if members would maybe pull out this long work plan to figure out how this next report fits in, I think the rest of the day today, much of the rest of the day today is related to your charge number two, mainly to your charge number two and perhaps into charge number three, looking at what the state is doing now, how effective it is, and what alternative incentives you may want to recommend. So part of doing that has been working with Mr. Berg and other legislative staff to try and get a combined comprehensive look at state investments in health workforce education and training. As Mr. Berg noted last time, I think that the default is that things can be compartmentalized between the different finance divisions. This, I know part of your hope, Mr. Chairman, was to bring certainly HHS and higher ed together here, so we have been working at the staff level to try and compile that kind of master look at what the state is now doing. And it's not finished yet, but what you have before you in these three, it's a three-page handout, three different spreadsheets. HHS division, higher ed division, and other. And it's a lot of information. Just tell you kind of how it's laid out here. You've got the name of the program itself, which may not tell you much, so we'll be filling in this second column here, where, you know, briefly a little description of the program, where the funding goes to or goes through by state agency, which finance division it's in, what the source of the funds are. And then you'll remember I threw up on the screen the pipeline diagram of kind of all the pieces of getting from start to finish with the healthcare workforce. And we've tried to kind of categorize what piece of that pipeline each program is directed towards. Then what the annual appropriation is in the far right, a subtotal at the bottom, and a grand total from all three pages below that. So that's what you're looking at. And you want to take a turn? Just walk you through here.
Sure,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Just a question I have on the chart itself. I see a TBD to be determined, or in MDH base. If the program is listed here and it says TBD, is that because it's newly started, has no funding yet, or you don't have the amount? Why would there be a...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, again, this is a work in progress. This is your first look at it.
Okay.
Legislative staff and MDH staff have requests out.
Okay.
To, for instance, the university and MNSCU, and we're doing some deeper digging into the budget. So as we learn those details, those will become numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's very valuable to have it all in one place. I mean, lots of times, but I appreciate that. And then is this the usual legislative thing where we add three zeros on the end of those numbers?
It is.
That's a big number, especially when the outstanding TBDs.
Mr. Chair, members, just following up, I think I'll jump off from that question and just starting on the Health and Human Services page. There's a number of things where we either have some requests out or we have yet to connect with the departments on it. I'll do an example, which if you go to number 14 on the Human Services page is the MA primary care rate add-on. Some members may know that as part of the ACA there's a temporary rate bump for primary care. We're going to have to connect with the department and try to see if they can isolate how much of MA payments, what actually is going into that. That is not a line item in our budget other than that medical assistance is, and it's way, way, way bigger than that piece of it. So there are things to be figured out on here yet. And in addition, I think I just add on to what Mark was saying. And in one respect, I think this list will never really be done. This is a resource. Mark and I have had some discussion and other staff about what constitutes spending on the part of the state that affects healthcare workforce training. And you can make an argument that all sorts of things do. Our whole MA expenditure, in one respect, we're paying for services in the marketplace. That drives somewhat what the healthcare workforce training will be because it's a supply and demand issue. We're paying for certain things in the marketplace. People will be trained. Providers will need to have those. So you get into a discussion about exactly what we're spending is on healthcare workforce training. A lot of the things you see on here are very specific things where we've identified we want to encourage rural physicians or nursing or something with loan forgiveness. But as you have this discussion, it expands broader and broader and broader on what is it that affects the whole pipeline. So I don't think this list really is ever meant to be a complete and say it's done. That said, the stuff that's on it, just I'm not, I think, going to walk through every item on this list. It's more of a resource for members. If you look at the Human Services Division one, that has maybe more programs than anything else. The one that jumps out there for you is the Merck program, which is, I think, safe to say, the sort of single biggest individual chunk of money we put out for a particular program that's meant to affect the healthcare workforce.
And we have a presentation on that.
Yeah, and that's coming up, so I won't go into that. And it's quite complicated in its funding, but it's sort of the big chunk of stuff we put out for this particular purpose.
Mr. Berg, does that $57 million, does that include the federal match?
No, that is just the state money portion.
Correct? No, that does include federal.
I'm sorry, I'm wrong.
Okay.
And that, but that is going for our various clinical training through the Merck program. It's not the only money that goes for clinical training, but it's the very large chunk of it. As you go down, you see we have a number of nursing scholarship programs, things for rural medicine, things at particular clinics and particular specialties. There are things, as I mentioned, that are in the MA program itself on rate bumps. We have some things on ambulance service that is meant to increase the amount of the workforce there. And a few things that are kind of, again, in the getting to the broader world category. At the end, you get to healthcare homes. You see items 19 and the one below at the SIM grant. Those aren't in particular meant to drive the healthcare workforce, but the things they're doing probably will have significant effect on the healthcare workforce. So I guess I'll leave it at that if members don't have questions.
I have a question on the ACO demonstration project. There was an article in the paper this morning, Minneapolis paper, on some of the early results from that. But I think the report came from the feds. It wasn't quite clear. But they did talk about at least three health systems in Minnesota that were on there, Medica, Fairview, and
Park Nicollet?
Yeah, I think it was Park.
Mr. Chairman, I probably don't have to tell you that there has been some encouraging early results from the ACO demonstrations. Legislative staff, aside from this, have been having a bunch of meetings with DHS staff about this, these kinds of issues in the last couple of weeks, and there is some reason to be optimistic that our system redesign efforts can produce more efficiency and lower costs. At the risk of saying something that'll touch us down a whole different road into budgeting, it's complicated at the legislature then to deal with that, because those savings occur as the forecast comes down for our future costs. The savings are kind of in the soup, and so when you go to do something else like train a new doctor or something else you want to do, the savings aren't sitting there as a pool of money that you can now spend. They're just spending you that you're not going to have to do that otherwise you would have. So that whole can of worms. I won't go further than that. In
Mr.
That
Chair, I'll concur. Right. I'm not going to bite, but yes, it's a constant frustration.
It gets really complicated really fast.
And Mr. Chairman, just this is the Workforce Commission, and you know, ACOs, as Mr. Berg said, will have some workforce. One expects they will have some workforce effects. Earliest research, as you've seen in the paper and as we're discussing, has been in some ways on the easiest thing to count, which is the finance side. Mm-hmm. The research and knowledge that we have on translating this phenomenon into workforce effects is just starting. So we know it will have an effect. I mean, as Mr. Berg said, some of these things are just there because we know they're related. But, you know, if you have 100,000 people in a successful ACO, do we know yet how many fewer specialists, how many more primary care physicians, how many nurse practitioners? We don't know that yet. The research isn't done. So I think it's somewhat, in some ways it's a watch this space entry on the spreadsheet.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
sorry.
Just in that vein, to try to frame it in another cast, I mean, the some of the effects are that if these ACOs are to work, the reason they work and the reason they produce savings is because we've changed the workforce that responds to the needs of the consumer and is more driven in bringing health to a population, and that's a changed workforce. And exactly how interdisciplinary teams and workforce changes roll out, that's, you know, we're not trying to dictate that. We're trying to say we want to pay for the results, and you guys figure out how the workforce needs to organize around the results that we're looking for. And that's why waiting for research is so critical, and we don't really have all of the answers. But as you mentioned, we are seeing some really interesting initial results. And we actually do know quite a bit about what needs to happen, but it's hard to have the right public policy levers.
Well, I would also say at our last meeting, maybe three or four people, you know, from the different groups that were testifying on workforce training, mentioned that one of their problems is they don't know what healthcare is going to be like five right. years from now. So how do they change their training when mm-hmm. they don't know what they're really going to be training for?
Right.
And I spent a couple of days this weekend at the MMA meeting, annual meeting, and they had a number of seminars on what does it mean to be a team, and how do you, what is the physician's role in those teams? And it's, we don't know yet.
All right.
Senator Kloss.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Picking up on your comments, I'm interested in your thoughts on number 17, which is the scope of practice. One of the things that's been discussed that in the future, this might be a significant change within the workforce and how roles of people change within the medical society. We dealt with this nurse practitioner issue in the House and Senate this last session in a very specific area. But I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of an overview of what you see in redesigning systems, what's out there for the future, what's currently being worked on or discussed.
We're looking at each other.
I guess I'll take a very brief stab at that, and maybe Mark can follow up on everything else. A couple of things. Again, this is one of the items that we, at the staff level, we've had discussion on. This is likely to be an item that doesn't necessarily ever get a specific number put to it because scope of practice changes have some effect. I guess I would say there's kind of two levels they do. One that is pretty easy for us to quantify, which is when we, at the legislative level, expand a license scope of practice. That happens occasionally. If there's a cost to it, you usually have a specific fiscal note. We're now going to allow a certain licensure to do something they weren't before. What will that cost in the licensing area? Will it have an impact on state spending, typically MA and Minnesota Care? We can, I think, I would say, usually isolate those. The bigger issue for scope of practice, though, for the future of the healthcare workforce is, do you have more advanced practice nursing? Do you have more physician's assistants? Where do you put them? How much of the sort of workload can you move further this way on the chain to have those folks deal with them rather than your most highly trained people? That's a very important thing in the whole future of this, but I think quantifying exactly what you want to do there and especially quantifying what happens to your payments on that is very hard to determine. And there's a lot of, again, I will say there's a lot of just uncertainty, and I don't want to say turf, but it is partly that issue of who does what. And again, determining how much you may have saved prospectively by having a few more physician's assistants or more advanced practice nursing in there, very difficult to say, put dollars on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Klassen, I'd agree. I mean, scope of practice changes, you know, will periodically be central to how the health system is evolving, and they go in that pipeline segment about redesigning the system with ACOs and healthcare homes and everything else. You know, as I'm looking at this entry on this spreadsheet, I'm not sure it really belongs in here. The out-of-pocket kind of regulatory costs to the state are going to be pretty modest. you know, and pretty one time. You know, after a change is made, it becomes, you know, ongoing responsibility of the related board. You know, I'm not sure it really belongs in here, unless you wanted to put kind of all occupational licensing in here, which we probably don't. I don't know, I'd be in, you know, why don't you help us at the staff, think about that with us. And, again, it belongs in the conversation. It belongs, you know, in your deliberations and your work. I'm not sure it belongs on a finance as I look at it today.
From a purely budget person perspective on the health board licensure, essentially, although not perfectly the case, the licensees pay the cost of their own regulation. I mean, there are times when the state has had to cover things, but typically when we change licensure scope, the license fee changes and the licensees pay the cost. So from a purely license regulatory standpoint, it's not a big budget item for the state to consider. The broader concept of who's going to do what in the workforce and how do we want to direct cases, that's a big important issue as part of the redesign, but it's very hard to get a financial handle on, at least.
I would just say, though, we haven't talked a lot about this, but we haven't talked much about dental. But the new dental hygiene, advanced hygiene, is, if it expands, and we have limited the number of slots and what they do, but if that were to expand and there are people in the dental profession that would like to greatly expand that, there are also people in the dental profession that would like to put an end to it, that could dramatically change dentistry if that were both the quality, or, I mean, it could be better, but it could be cheaper. Who knows? But that's a huge issue.
Mr. Chairman, great point. And if you look at line 18 on this HHS division, some of that federal SIM grant that's also supporting the Medicaid ACOs is also being directed to support the rollout of dental therapists and community paramedics and community health workers. So that probably does fit, again, because there's some specific money being spent on that. That probably does fit here. But let's all take another look at whether we want to leave number 17 on this sheet or not.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question I have for you on the ACO. The article talked about federal incentives, and one received, I think, about $2.1 million in an award back. One was a wash, and the other one was a negative. But that's on the federal level. Does these ACO federal measurements, are they measured the same on the state level? Is there any connection between this federal ACO and the state ACO as far as these finances go? I mean, the fact that one system got some money, one didn't, one says they lost?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I mean, the generic answer is yes. I mean, these people are in both the ACO and then, to throw in another thing, we have a thing which is now called Integrated Health Partnerships, which are our demonstration grant programs, which is where the state got into this. There's Medicare and Medicaid folks in there, which the state and federal governments are partners in payments on these. We have a couple of demonstration projects going, a number of providers, and so it gets very complicated. Now, the ACO original report that Representative Huntley is talking about indicated savings in medical assistance, I believe it was, that were in the range, I wanted to say, of $10 million, but I think that is both state and federal savings there. So under our partnership arrangement, the state will get half of those savings and the feds will accrue half of those savings. Then within the state end of things, well, no, this actually would now you've got me to a question I don't know the answer to. Because we have incentives in our integrated health partnerships for shared savings to the providers. Both the state and the providers who participate in this, if they save money by doing an integrated partnership, the providers share in the savings and the state shares in the savings. Now you have me thinking about whether we take the shared savings prior to our split with the federal government. And I actually do not know off the top of my head the answer to that question. So the $10 million in savings we're talking about is half state, half federal. But I don't know off the top of my head if that's before or after we've done shared savings with the providers. I think it's after. But don't hold me to that. I'll have to check into it. It's a complicated arrangement.
I have one more question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Giffmeyer.
Thank you. On this list of workforce support or training, question I have for you, does this include, or maybe we don't do this, dental, podiatry, physician assistant, vision, eye occupations at all, or is this purely this is it right here? Have we just? I know it's a work in draft, so you may have asked, and it's just not here yet.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, if you turn, sort of, I think is the answer. If you turn to the higher ed division page, we did get a number 13, from MNSCU on the budget for their health professions program. And that's not a state-only number. That's, if I understand correctly, that's the total cost of their program. So we haven't yet separated out the state share. But to the extent that they train some of these other occupations, some of it would be in there. We also had a conversation about if and how to capture activity of private colleges. And we haven't really made a lot of progress there other than with kind of the general thought that to the extent students at private colleges receive state higher education support, state scholarship grants, that's a state contribution. So that's how far we've gotten on that type of thing.
That's helpful.
And
thank
I'd
you.
Follow up there on the issue of MNSCU's credit base, and I think just on a technical detail, getting to that page, we haven't got this information quite from the university yet, but there are other staff working with you on it. Just because Mark said the state share there, I want to be clear in a context where a lot of people are familiar with the human services. We don't have a partnership with the federal government on higher education like MA. By state share, what Mark's referring to is the appropriation for it. The bulk of the rest of the money and their costs would come from tuition. So just to confuse everybody here, in the higher ed committee, you would refer to all of that as state spending, tuition, and state appropriation, and it's going to constitute the bulk of the actual payment for those services. There will be some other dollars in there, but there isn't a federal share in there like there is in human services. So that's one of the things here where you're going across divisions, you have to be careful. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the same thing over in the higher ed committee that it does in the human services committee. So,
yeah.
Senator Lurie.
You know, as the conversation goes on, it seems what we're trying to capture in these spreadsheets is the total investment in higher ed medical healthcare workforce issues. And a couple of pieces that jump out at me are like some of the private investment, the cost borne by the provider community in residency programs. I know Hennepin County or, you know, maybe county costs and some of the Hennepin County programs. Mayo, I know, has a lot of costs tied up in theirs. And if we want to capture, you know, the total investment, you know, those are avenues that we might need to consider. Otherwise, it won't be consistent across there. And I'm not saying which way we should go. I mean, maybe we should try to rein it in to just the state expenditures. And then another key part as we do footnotes on this, I think that because of that if that remains the goal of this type of a spreadsheet, we should say these aren't, you know, because if these are passed out to legislators, we often think, you know, we get kind of into our own role and think that we did all of this. It should be made clear. These aren't all legislative decisions. I mean, what goes on in Minsk-U, we give them a large budget and they, you know, kind of figure out what works with the students who are coming forward and they ferret it out. So just a couple of thoughts as we develop this. I don't have the answers to all of these, but just a couple of things that I look at when I see it. The other one that actually I don't know how the heck you'd put on there is number 15 on the HHS side, the long-term care wage issue. Certainly that is toward partially toward retention when we fund more of that, but when do you at what point do you start? You know, I mean, just new investments in it? I don't know what you'll ever fill that TBD in with. Just another stray comment as I look at this and try to figure out how we'd use it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's the discussion we've been having a lot at the staff level. The edges of this are very gray.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of programs that we have that we can put numbers to that are specific, but you quickly get into a discussion about who's spending what and how much does it really affect it into some sort of soft areas where it's going to be very hard to sort of figure out where the end of it ever is.
And the I would say the complicated, I mean, we've heard numerous times that it's training sites in clinics or hospitals that are kind of the holdup.
Yep.
And who pays for that? You know, and how do you evaluate? Is the state paying for it? Is the hospital just eating the cost or whatnot? And what does the hospital get for doing that?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you one thing they get is that if they're training. I had eye surgery last year ago, and my physical exam before the surgery was done by a PA, and a PA student from Augsburg. So, you know, what was an Augsburg student doing in Duluth? And why was the Duluth system slowing down their regular PA? And somehow they must think it's worth it. And I think what they're thinking about is they get to look at these PA students and decide which ones are really good and which ones they'd like to hire. And how do you figure the dollar value of that? I don't think there's any way you can do that.
Well, and Mr. Chair and members, maybe to just kind of bring that to the last sheet that we haven't really looked at on a similar issue, I'd highlight just on the very last one, the other finance divisions, the number 4 telehealth there. And we've had some discussion at the staff level about this involves things like spending of state money on broadband connections for rural Minnesota. And so how much is the impact of and what the dollar value of a clinic in rural Minnesota being able to have a clinical trainee connect to somebody at the University of Minnesota or Mayo or some other place via electronic means rather than have either the doc go up there or them come down? There's an increasing amount of that. The state's spending money in various divisions to improve that. How do you quantify how much impact it has either on a dollar value or a program value? For it obviously has some impact, but I'm not sure we can actually quantify it.
In that same article this morning, there was, speaking of telehealth, one of the more interesting things was the, I guess it was one of the systems hired a geriatric nurse practitioner to work at night to answer phone calls from nursing homes. Typically, the patients would have been sent to the hospital in almost every case. And in the current system, with this nurse practitioner, advising the nursing home about what they should do with this. They've saved a lot of money and made the people healthier. And telehealth.
A lot of potential in that.
Is there another question over here?
Well, I was just going to say that it seems as though in just this conversation that there, I look at having direct provider things that I see here, the training subsidy, the Merck program, those are what I would consider direct. I think some of the other ones, like you brought up, Senator Lori, are more of an indirect support to the system. But I think having them broken out by direct and indirect would be helpful to us. I think sometimes another chart could be the other. I mean, what do? You know it has an impact, but it doesn't rise to an indirect, but are just factors that may affect it, such as the telehealth would be one of those. And it may be both. Maybe telehealth has a direct provider line. But I think in some way I would rather see it broken out so I know what is the actual direct and then the indirect on a separate. Because I think I think what we're looking for, healthcare workforce direct, I think is more what we're trying to get a handle on from what everything I've seen on our agenda.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Senator Claussen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. To kind of pick up on Senator Kiffmeyer's question, as you look at these numbers, we're investing millions of dollars into the healthcare workforce, but there's no guarantee on our return for investment that those people are actually going to enter the Minnesota workforce. I'm wondering if any study's been done to show what that return on investment is, or within these programs, are there any incentives built in to keep people in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Claussen, you'll get a taste of a piece of that later today. I mean, there are loan forgiveness, for instance, is specifically designed to do just that. There, and we'll hear about that this afternoon. There is also a body of research that tracks students and trainees and looks at where they train and where they end up practicing. And you may want to ask your residency program directors this afternoon about their experience. But generally speaking, there's a pretty close relationship between where someone trains and where they end up practicing. And I know I think we've heard from both from the university and from Mayo, I believe, that a great share, I forget what the percentage is, but it's very high, of the people that train through their institutions end up working in Minnesota. Sure.
Senator Claussen.
Just to follow up, have we actually, from the state level, done any studies to show the return on investment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Claussen, no.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would add I think well beyond stuff that we could do any specific data relative to the healthcare workforce. You get into it, occurs to me you raise an issue that is sort of the basic discussion that happens sometimes in higher education about the state's tuition reciprocity agreements with other states. I will tell you from previous years' experience with that, there are a lot of assumptions and assertions and secondary data. There's not a lot of primary data on that. I sort of would summarize it that people over the years have argued that it's our reciprocity agreements are a pretty good deal for the state because we have people go to other good colleges like University of Wisconsin-Madison or some others and get trained, and then they often come back here because we have a better, stronger economy and they have ties here. However, I think when you get to the professional training level, as Mark was saying, when somebody's in a residency program, that's going to have more of a pull than did they go from Minneapolis to Madison to get their bachelor's degree in nursing. So there's a couple levels. And as I say, I wouldn't, I guess, recommend that we get into that debate. I will say there's not a lot of primary data on our return on investment there. There's secondary data about the economies in the various states and workforces and unemployment figures and things like that that suggest our reciprocity agreements are a pretty good deal for us.
Senator Klassen?
Yeah, thank you. And I realize this goes pretty deep because you could take, for instance, clinical dental education grants or the nursing facility scholarship program. Those are investments we're making too, but we really don't know what the outcome is as far as workforce expansion in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Klassen, some places we have a little data. You'll hear we have good data on loan forgiveness. That's why we're presenting it this afternoon. Other places, it's more anecdotal. And as the commission thinks about, you know, both its initial report this year and its report, final report, a couple years later, I think we're going to get a start at asking and answering some of these questions this year in 2014. But you may want to add to your future work plan and add to your recommendations some additional evaluation looks at some of the other investments that the state makes.
Thank you.
Just a brief question. Telehealth, does that include electronic medical records or is that separate?
Mr. Chairman, you ask a question where the answer has been changing over the last couple of years. I think historically they've been separate, and in the definition here, we're not talking about electronic health records. We're talking about the delivery of medical services as opposed to capturing what's happened in those medical services. I think the thought leaders and the head of the pack systems out there are starting to see a convergence where care is delivered in a variety of ways. It's all connected through the electronic health record, and the lines are becoming blurrier. But for this discussion, we're not talking about electronic health records.
We, I'm sort of familiar with the med school where I taught. The head of the, he was then head of the behavioral science group. He was a psychologist. Was one of the first ones in the country to do treatment of patients by TV. Talk to the patient. The patient didn't have to come and see him. And a very interesting concept, and particularly with mental health, that's transportation is a huge issue. Okay, let's move on.
I don't know that I have anything else.
I'm up. I'm still up next. I'll be here for another. So we'll move on. We'll move on to Merck here. Again, it's been a great partnership working with Mr. Berg and legislative staff, and we will we'll keep working on these facts and figures and keep them keep updating you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman and members, Merck was on the agenda last time. We ran out of time. I think it fits just as well today. The goal today is to present you with kind of an introduction and overview of the program. Administering the program for the last couple of years, I'm reminded every day of the countless details that interplay with each other. But we'll try and do some big picture stuff today and see how it goes. So this program, the short end is MERC, Medical Education and Research Costs is the full name. We've labeled it Minnesota's Clinical Training Support Program. There has never been any research money through the program. So that word is a remnant of, I think, some hopes originally. The justification you see here is for the state's involvement in supporting clinical training, that it benefits society at large. And so society at large has a contribution to make. Looking through the history, that was explicit from the beginning. My slides don't want to move here. Let's try something else. The shape of the program came out of a task force in 1995. I don't need to go through all this, but you can see some of the same principles that we're still discussing today were included from the beginning. You will also see that the approach to distributing the funds has changed periodically since it began. Originally, it was based entirely on the training volume and training costs of training sites and institutions. Of important note, starting in 2007, largely at the requirement of the federal government, because the Medicaid program contributes to MERC, the federal government in 2007 required that by and large the distribution be based on the Medicaid revenue of each training site, and that has had a major effect on how the funds are distributed. And in 2013 was the last time you here at the legislature made a change to the formula. It retains that central feature that 100% of the fund, or that the funds are distributed 100% based on each site's Medicaid revenue, and it made another tweak or two also.
And that, just so the members of us, that's to maximize the federal money.
Maximize federal money, and that's been a principle of the MERC program. Legislatures have used since the beginning, and you'll see that at play here on this next slide. You can't see the screen, but I hope this what's called sources and uses table is big enough. Is it big enough to see the numbers in your handout? Mainly when people talk about MERC, they're talking about this $57 million that is distributed to training sites by formula. And that's obviously the biggest part here, but there are, and as you can see, the money for that comes in. Sources on the right is kind of where the money comes from, and uses on the left is where the money goes. So for the MERC formula, the money comes predominantly from a carve-out of the state's medical assistance managed care program. Again, half of that money would be federal money. There is a direct statutory contribution from the cigarette tax that also goes into the formula, and that cigarette tax money travels through the Medicaid program and also picks up federal match. And the money you can see there, that $57 million, goes back out through the formula that we just looked at. A couple of years ago, the legislature also made an appropriation from the Healthcare Access Fund that is independent of the formula for Greater Minnesota Family Medicine Residency Programs, $1 million, and you will hear from those residency programs this afternoon. There's also kind of a whole other often invisible part of what runs through the Merck statute, which is initiated with transfers into the Department of Human Services from the University of Minnesota that, again, travel through the Medicaid program and pick up federal match. The university gets all of that money back. And if you look in the right-hand column here, so the university contributes $19 million back. The match on some of that is then used for other purposes. Some of it is used for clinical medical education at Hennepin County Medical Center. Some of it funds the dental innovation program at the health department that we discussed a moment ago. And not quite $9 million of it goes into the general fund. There may have been a connection to medical education originally with that $8.7 million, but I haven't been able to discover that it's still connected. It goes into the general fund. So that's the kind of the big picture money flow for the Merck program.
Let me be, probably shouldn't say this in public, but the U of M transfers, they write us a check the last week of December, and then we write them the money back first week of January.
It's not quite that straightforward, Mr. and I will have to get back to you on the details. Actually, our accounting department handles that. But it does involve, I think there's, I don't remember exactly how it comes in and how it moves from between health and DHS. It does go back out on more of a monthly basis. If you're interested, I can get you the need.
Yeah.
So we'll get to the formula in a minute. We already talked about kind of these funds that are outside the formula. Here's a recap, just kind of a standalone slide with how that that $57 million is derived. Unless there's any questions, I'll move on. But it'd be hopefully this can be a reference for you. To the formula itself. Here's kind of how the funds are allocated. So to be eligible for a Merck grant, a training site must be a Medicaid provider. Again, this program is centrally tied to the Medicaid program. And then funds, as was discussed, are divided based on the pool of Medicaid, relatively on the pool of Medicaid volume of all applicants. That's a very, there's not necessarily always a tight connection between Medicaid volume and training activity. So in law, there are some outlier components of the formula, and you see them listed there. At an earlier point in the program's history, the largest sites received an additional allocation, and in 2013, the legislature lowered that and then called for its phase-out.
Mr. Schoenbaum, what do you mean by largest sites? That's the largest MA volume or just...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. There was a...
So Hennepin County Medical Center.
Among others. here are the disciplines that whose training can be reimbursed through the Merck program. And again, I don't have to read them to you. Some of these were added. Some of these have been there all along. Some of these, particularly the mental health occupations, were added in 2013. And sites must be funded in part by patient care revenue. So, for instance, the federal hospitals, the Shriners, are not eligible for Merck funds. The funds...
That would be the VA hospital.
Yes.
Is not eligible.
Correct. The current law provides that the funds must be spent on clinical training, kind of a basic accountability provision, and along those same lines, sites are now required to report their expenses. So to your question earlier, Senator Lurie, or your thought about capturing the total investment by all parties involved, at least in this graduate training, over time we'll have a better handle on that because we'll be collecting expenditures from participants in Merck. Again, I'm sure this is also a little hard to read on the screen, but just some highlights of who gets the money. Last year, 369 sites received funds from Merck. Most of it went to hospitals. Next to physician clinics, some to the other training location types that you see here, and 70% of the funds are to training sites in Hennepin and Ramsey County. The graphic at the bottom, again, shows...
So we have a question from Senator Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's in part a question, but also in part a discussion I think is really important for us as a commission. Our medicine has changed so much. There's so much more going on in clinics. I mean, the whole goal is to keep them out of the hospital, where you more often have the most expensive type care. And so this is something that I think for us on the commission to consider. Do we want to make sure that we include maybe more clinic-based training, because that fits in with our overall goal, which is let's try not have them go to the hospital. Now, when they go there, we certainly want physicians trained in hospital thing, but more and more, what I've heard from the physicians, more and more work is happening in the clinics, and that our new docs need to be trained in that sort of approach, which is what can we do outside of the hospital, maximizing that. And so right now our Merck distribution is so heavily favored on a hospital thing that I think we ought to maybe give that some thought about the Merck funding and thinking about, do we want new doctors trained more in that clinic approach or just or so heavily predominantly in a hospital? Especially now that you have some of these integrated systems, but I think this can work out really well for them. But I'm just noticing on these numbers, again, emphasizing that 83-84% is going to the hospitals. And so I think that's a decision for us to talk about as a commission. I appreciate Mr. Schoenborn and your keeping track of the numbers and the percentages would tell us the story. But I think as part of our recommendations, do we want to kind of shift that a little bit into the clinic experience specifically because of the overall approach to medicine?
Yeah. Mr. Schoenbaum, when you say hospitals, what do you do about a hospital that also has independent, not independent, but has clinics?
Mr. Chairman, all the parts of hospitals are generally grouped under that hospital umbrella. So hospital training that happens in hospital outpatient departments and hospital-based clinics does show up in this categorization as part of that 83.9%. Exactly what the split is between inpatient, you know, patient training with patients in inpatient beds and what happens elsewhere in the hospital or related clinics, I don't think we have a great handle on, but if there's interest, we can try and learn more about that.
I think it'd be very good to kind of know that breakdown of that 84%. If a survey or query can be put out, that gives a rough estimate even, because things change from year to year, so if we can just have a rough idea how the breakdown is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, we'll start out on that. I'll tell you, it's probably not going to be quick and simple, but we'll
right. Nothing ever is. Thank you.
We can ask some questions this afternoon when because the Duluth.
That's a good thing. They're going to be here.
Family Practice Residency Program is actually run by St. Luke's Hospital and St. Mary's Hospital,
mm-hmm.
although it's a separate facility. But it's run, so I'd be interested to know where the accounting shows up for mm-hmm. that particular. And I'm sure that happens all over the place, because I think the one in St. Cloud is closely associated with the hospital system, although it's a separate clinic. And I don't know. I would guess Mankato is the same. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the distribution of funds, do any of these funds flow to the higher ed institutions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Claussen, the higher education institutions have a central role here. If you go back a slide,
right.
The program is really dependent on the goodwill of those sponsoring institutions. They take in the applications from training sites, kind of aggregate them for the health department. The money flows back out. So rather than doing 369 grant agreements, the department does grant agreements with 20-some sponsoring institutions. They redistribute the money back out to their affiliated training sites. And they do that out of goodwill and they have other reasons, but they do it for free. I'll certainly say that. But unless they are a training site themselves, the money is passed through.
And, you know, Mr. Schoenbaum, if you could, they won't be testifying this afternoon, but the Cook Clinic, which is a community clinic in a sort of poor part of Minneapolis, but it's completely owned by the University of Minnesota Medical School, I guess, and they have residents there, lots of them. I'd be interested to know where does that show up on this list?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. They do get a grant identified specifically for that clinic. I would assume it's counted under the clinic category, but I'll check for you.
Okay. If you want to visit an exciting place, that'd be the place to go. It's just unbelievable.
Maybe we just get the address and information. Might make it.
Once you turn to this sideways table here, there was no perfect way to show this diagram. So I decided to show it so you could at least read what the occupations are, what the disciplines are. So we've looked at kind of the type of institution, training site that gets the funds. Here are the division of funds between professions. And you can see that both the largest number of trainees and the largest share of the pool is received for training of medical residents, followed by med students and advanced practice nurses. And moving on, again, I hope this is readable in your handouts. Here were the top 20 by dollar amount recipients in 2014. The entire list of the 369 and additional information is available on the Health Department website. If anyone is interested, we'll be happy to get you that link. And you can also see on the following slide, again, kind of just the range of grant sizes. The most common grant is between $20,000 and $50,000. So that's a quick walkthrough of some of the Merck basics. Again, I think it fits your charge in looking at kind of what the state is doing, how it's working.
Questions? Don't see any. So thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. Is it lunchtime now?
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me.
So, do you have any recommendations how long we can take?
I know some of the afternoon panelists were not planning to arrive until 1. But we're at just about noon now.
Right.
I mean, I think it's up to you. We can switch the order of the agenda. Our final presenter is here. So I think it's up to you, all of you. You know, we could do...
why don't we do... is that Will Wilson?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to have to be very nice to him because he's originally from Duluth. Lived about a half a block from my house.
Oh, my.
So why don't we get number 7 on the agenda done, and then, Will, you can go have a long lunch. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Will Wilson from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care in the Department of Health. Happy to be here. Always happy to talk about loan forgiveness. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you're right. It was, I think, about a snowball's throw from your yard to our yard. I think we did that as kids, too.
Well, you were downhill.
Yeah,
easy for us to do it.
Well, I'm just here to give sort of a hopefully brief and substantive explanation and a little bit of evaluation of our program. Over the years, there have been some changes. It has grown in the professions that are eligible for the program. It has grown and then shrunk again in funding, and we'll see some of that as we get going. You have 3 handouts, and I'll go sort of... Yes, that's it. Great. Okay, so unfortunately, there was a second page to the third one that didn't print out, so we're trying to get it up on the screen at least. I'll go in order with the first one is the Loan Forgiveness in Minnesota handout, and this is just basically kind of the various programs that we have in our state. The first one is our program, our state's Loan Forgiveness Program. You can see there very briefly. I'll get more into detail with the next handout, but who's eligible for the program and a little bit of information. They have to... Yes, that's it. Awardees have to agree to serve a minimum of 3 years. They can serve an optional fourth year. A little over half do serve that extra fourth year, especially once you get up into the higher award amounts. Current funding is $740,000 a year, but remember that we have to budget for those 4 years. So there's only $185,000 per year that's available for new resident or for new participants. As you see with the funding we had this last year, we have 16 new awards, and that's all categories that are listed above, roughly two physicians, two pharmacists, et cetera. Just for
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lurie.
Real quick, though, but if that 740, presuming it keeps up year after year after year, this year's folks would get the full benefit of the 740
yes.
over the 4 years.
It will follow them.
Yeah.
The 185 is only for the new participants in the program.
For
the rest
first
of it is budgeted to pay for the rest of those 3 or 4 years.
Right, but if we keep that up, it's, yeah.
It maintains itself.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, and just for context, we had 57 applications in all categories this last year. That holds true historically. It's roughly between 3 and 4 times the number of awards with the number of applicants. And honestly, we don't do a lot of marketing for the program. We don't have to, and there isn't a lot of funding available. So it's, we don't want to overpromise. But we do get good applicants. We could have funded probably 30, 32 very easily this year. The next program on this handout is the National Health Service Corps. This is a federal program run by HRSA, and it's a bigger program. It's also it's available for more provider types, especially mental health providers, as you can see there. The difference between this program, or a couple differences. One is it's only a 2-year term, It's a specific participant-to-site match. Our program, the state program, has different criteria for each profession. This one, they actually have to work in a site that is approved by the National Health Service Corps. And that could include federally qualified health centers. I believe there are maybe 100 or 150 sites, something like that. I'll get that number to you, where they can work, but it's a specific match. You can see there's 140 providers who were selected to receive funds for the program. And the last program is a state and federal joint program. It's $100,000 in federal money that we match with state dollars. And that usually gets us about maybe 5 to 6 recipients. And the categories of professions are the same as for the National Health Service Corps. So any questions about this one? I'll move on to the next one. It's the grid that says the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness and Repayment Programs. This is a little bit more detailed shot of the program. Most of this is governed by statute. A lot of this is just statutory language that we put in a grid that you can see. So the first column there is just the categories of providers, and we give a little more detail as to who is eligible. For example, under the physician category, we try to focus it on primary care. I will point out that under the second column for practice locations, it says the designated rural area is a city or township that is outside the 7-county metropolitan area and has a population under 15,000. You and the legislature changed that last year from a much more restrictive definition that was based on something called RUPAs, which did significantly limit the sites that were eligible for receiving a participant. That rural definition applies for the physician, the pharmacist, and the mid-level practitioners. Nurses have to work in a licensed nursing home or an ICFDD. Most of them work in nursing homes. I think in the history of the program, we've only had two that have worked in an ICF. The dentist is a very different structure. They have to work in a clinic anywhere in the state. There's no geographic requirement. They have to work in a clinic or practice that sees at least 25% public recipients, public program recipients. And then finally, there's just a brief description of the State Loan Repayment Program, which is also called SLRP, which is my favorite acronym that we have in our office. And that brings us to the last handout, which is the Loan Forgiveness Program Evaluation. And here we've got the second side is coming around as well. I'll go through this sort of quickly, and maybe we can get into more of it with I'd be happy to answer any questions. So we've been, the program itself has undergone two major evaluations in 1999 and in 2007. Most of the findings that are that it's an efficiently run program that is meeting its goals of recruiting and retaining practitioners in underserved areas. It's also been shown to be quite effective in the decision-making process of people coming out of school as to where they're intending to practice. Over half of the physicians said that this was an important or very important component in their decision-making process about where they wanted to practice. And I'll show you a little bit towards the bottom there. This is the historical funding for the program. Right now, the $740,000 has been coming out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and all of the professions, with the exception of the MMA Foundation, which I'll get into in a second, all of the professions come out of that same bucket. So if we're expanding the professional types or adding a new profession into this, I think we would prefer to have additional funding come with that, because if without it, it drains the bucket for the rest of the professions. So historically, you can see there were a couple of other funding sources, special revenue funds, and those were more targeted towards professions. The MMA Foundation money is actually a partnership that we have with them. They are very graciously giving us $50,000 per year. The funding ends this year, but they're giving us $50,000 per year to fund half of the awards for physicians. And we receive that money as an income contract and distribute it just like we do with the rest of our program. We run it the same way. That partnership has been really successful, and we're very happy to be working with them, and hopefully that will continue. Finally, at the bottom, you can see the number of awards. There's quite a bit of variation in this. One of the reasons why is because one year we might give more physicians awards, and that significant, I mean, one physician is essentially four or five nurses in terms of this program. That's not a comment, but not an editorial comment, but you know, for our program. And so over the years, even with higher funding, you can see that there were maybe fewer awards, but that just meant that there were more physicians that received funding. And now to the back page, which is an evaluation that we've just recently done. And I need to give some context on this, too. The physician, mid-level, pharmacist, dentist, and faculty were relatively easy to track down because we verified that with board data. But the nursing program was difficult because the nursing board does not track where licensed nurses are working. And so what we did is we looked back through time for as long as these programs existed, and looked at retention rate, and we defined retention as being still eligible for the program. They may not be working in the same facility, but they would still be working in a rural area, or in the case of a dentist, they'd be working in a clinic that sees at least 25% public program recipients. So some more context on this. Of the studies that we've seen, and there's one of them that's cited on the first page, at the bottom of the first page, of the studies that we've seen, usually they look at about 4 or 5 years after program participation nationally, this one did, and they found that it was roughly between 60 and 65% of recipients were still working in a facility that was eligible for the program. And that includes physicians, and, you know, that's pretty good numbers. But if you look at ours, our numbers are significantly better. And I think in part that's because our selection process is finding the right people. One of the things that we really look at is you know, through the applicants submit a resume and they submit an essay and letters of reference, things like that. And we're really looking for commitment to working in a rural area or working with underserved populations throughout their career. We score that in the application, and I think this kind of bears out that we're finding the right candidates for this program, and our retention numbers show that. So the last one I would just mention are sort of nurse. We surveyed roughly half of the people who had gone through the program, and the reason there's no data on the in the first column there is because we didn't reach anybody. They were a little hard to contact. What we've heard from the industry is that turnover in the nursing profession in nursing homes is roughly 33% per year. We're still doing okay, even with this sort of small data set. And the last one is dentists. That throughout our program, this is long-term retention has been low, and that may be more attributable to a rate issue than a desire to work in a facility. The dentist profession just seems a little different in that regard. So with that, hope everybody's okay.
Is that a doctor in the house?
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to call attention, because I think for us as commission members, this one sentence here is really important. It says that retention outcomes for loan forgiveness are better than other incentives such as scholarships or stipends. I think for us as policymakers, that's a really important statement. Would you care to comment about why that may be the case? Or,
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, that comes from the same study that's cited on the bottom of the first page. And what they found is that with loan forgiveness, these are people that are coming out of school, they're probably starting families, and so that time that they're under an obligation that they have to stay there, if it's 3 years in our case or four, then there's a better chance that they stay than if they just receive funding as they're just coming out of school and then the world is kind of open to them. I think that's sort of what the study postulated.
Mm-hmm. So. If they left, they would have to pay back their loan for you.
That's correct, plus interest.
So a combination of good screening, I think, as you mentioned, is really important that they fit. One of the things that I've heard is that the people who come out of rural tend to like rural anyway, and with a little bit of incentive and help, they will naturally want to go there. Is that part of your screening assessment as well? I mean, there's a certain bent to people's comfort that they will gravitate back to.
It is. We look for. It's a broad category of commitment, but experience is also because we don't want to. You know, there are a lot of good candidates, but if they don't have any experience with rural, in particular, they might not know what they're in for. And so we do look for experience and a desire to work there.
A follow up to that, Mr. Chairman. So one of the things that we talk about opening up. Some more slots, as they're called, for some of these residencies or training situations is that some people might have an interest in that rural or some of the hard-to-serve inner urban areas, but they haven't lived in it. And so these residencies that can be in more rural settings also can be very helpful. I mean, if that's our targeted goal, is to have that, then giving them that experience in a residency can help them, and then loan forgiveness can help get them there or keep them there. But residency also can really matter because the kind of experience they have, especially if you've never had it before but have an interest. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think we'll hear that from the panelists after lunch.
Okay.
And they can probably be a lot more authoritative than I can about that.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Having served, in fact, I was chair for a year of the admissions committee for the UMD Medical School, we really tried to figure out which kids were more likely to be in the go work in a rural area. And you're never 100% correct, but in fact, I used to joke that we should forget about interviewing the applicant. We should interview the applicant's spouse.
Well, there may be some
advantage. Very important in deciding where that couple is going to live.
And frequently, I would like to do this. However, if your spouse is very urban or very rural, that, of course, and it rightfully should have an impact.
However, it's illegal to ask those questions.
Yeah. Well, certainly don't want to do that. You might have a coffee chat.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Wilson? Thank you for your testimony, and we will take a 45-minute break, and lunch is here.
Okay. That was nice, too, to get a little bump jump in the agenda.
In fact, I'm probably in Minnesota because
I find these. Especially
yeah, I'm from here, but I kind of like Connecticut. But I knew.
That's where this is so helpful.
Hartford.
Yeah. I think it's
taking but I knew every summer we'd be heading back. Every Christmas we'd be heading back.
I also know several people that after, especially college, or even after high school, in college, or after a lot of Minnesotans went to my classmates. I mean, they were spread across the country and the world, and still are. But as the years went by, more and more started coming back because they knew, like, this is a great place to raise a family. There's a high quality of life. And so even though they are in wonderful places in California and New York and in between, more and more every year, they more and more come back every year. All right.
Thanks for starting.